So again, good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending our Sunday Sangha gathering. I've said in the last couple of weeks, it's nice to see members back in the hall, but this week is really kind of special because we're actually able to see each other's faces. It has been a long time where we've just sort of seen each other from the eyes up. Right, so it's nice to be able to see the full face again. May it continue. So this morning I wanted to continue with what I was doing several weeks ago with kind of looking at these gathas, these verses that are really part of the way we practice here, that we hear, but we often hear, or we may hear on automatic pilot, not realizing that these are really very insightful teachings that are being given to us. But before I get into that, I just want to just talk briefly about something which I think is very central to our practice for all of us. I think many of you know every week I do interviews with members in various kinds of settings, individually, group. And it's funny, this week, one theme I heard from some people was a sort of, almost a sort of a defeatism in terms of their ability to change. Especially people who have had long-term issues that have seemed to have always been with them or always keep returning. Many people kind of feel, well, this is just who I am, or this is just the way it is, and my ability to be free in this lifetime is really impossible. I can remediate somewhat, obviously, make my life somewhat better, but I'll never really be free of this. Which again, I think is very American, unfortunately. That we do so identify, with our issues, with our psychological issues and problems. And I had to say to them, Buddhism really comes at this in a radically different way, going back to the time of the Buddha. I mean, the Buddha says that, and I sort of asked people, are you familiar with Buddhism and the Buddha's enlightenment, which is really, Buddhism began with the Buddha's enlightenment. Up to then, he was just Siddhartha, sort of the errant son of of his clan and father. Kind of their ne'er-do-well, I'm just making that up, who kind of left his home, left his family, and is off wandering around being a spiritual seeker. But maybe some of your family members think that about you. but anyhow, so I mean, things changed. He became the Buddha when he had his great enlightenment. It's important to understand that that was a transform. He'd done a lot of different practices, had different teachers up to then, but it was really when he really was able to penetrate deeply into his true nature, the nature of who he really was, that he became enlightened. The lights went on and he could see clearly. I mean, his statement then, and you've probably been around, you've heard me say it many times, he said, wonder of wonders. In this body, 5 feet something high. I mean, he didn't have feet and inches. He said, there is this pure, undefiled, uncontaminated nature that is indestructible. It's beyond birth and death. It's always been here. It will always be here. It's sort of like saying, who would have ever believed it? He certainly didn't. And that it's always here. And no matter what's happened in life, in any way it's been conditioned, it is as pure and uncontaminated as ever. I said, so I say to people, this is the most fundamental teaching of Dharma, that we all have this. And the Buddha said, every sentient being has this Buddha nature, this awakened nature. Not just some, everyone. This is the nature of everyone's mind. So it's important to understand that. You know, but if you can't understand that, what I often say to people who identify with their issues, I said, you were not, you know, do you really believe that when you came out of, when you were born and you came into the world, you came into the world with issues? You know, no, you didn't come in the world with issues. You came in the world, at least for this lifetime, in a very pure mind. You had no language. You know, how could you have issues? Try to have an issue without language. You had no language. Everything that you identify with has happened since birth. If it has happened since birth, then it is not original to you. That's just logical. It's not original to you. It happened afterwards because of causes and conditions. But, you know, your original nature was pure and is pure. And you know, practice is about uncovering, unfolding, purifying, many different ways of looking at it, so we can touch, tap into, realize, experience the true nature. And again, that sounds very highfalutin, but it's really just, you know, the original nature of our natural mind. It's like we don't have to do anything, you see. We don't have to create it. We don't have to buy it. We don't have to go anywhere to get it. If it's our natural mind, if it's our original nature, it has to be right here. And the obvious question is, well, if it's right here, how come I don't see it? Well, that is really the only difference between awakened and unawakened people. It's really that simple, right? Right. I mean, what's the difference between blind people and people who can see? There's really just one major difference, isn't there? And so we have to remember that. So please remember that. This is essential. Buddhism is not a faith-based tradition, as many of traditions are. But there is this article of faith, really, which is, you know, in what I just said, that we have faith, we have confidence that this is true, even though it hasn't been our experience yet. That when we read the teachings of the Buddha, going back to his enlightenment, and we read, the accounts, the teachings of all the masters, the men and women who have enlightened themselves practicing the Buddha's way in the last 2,600 years, they all say the same thing. Whether they're Indian, whether they're Tibetan, whether they're Chinese, whether they're Vietnamese, whether they're Japanese or Korean or Southeast Asian or, you know, or European or American or African, it doesn't matter. Everyone says the same thing when they realize their mind. So please reflect on that if you're one of the ones who mouth the words but really don't believe it. You know, that's what it means, you know, we talk about taking refuge, right? That's a kind of an essential part of kind of entering the path, is to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But to take refuge means you take refuge in something you trust. Right? Why take refuge in something you don't trust? So you take refuge in something you trust. And so this teaching that I'm sharing, you know, this is what we take refuge in. This is what we trust. Unfortunately, many of us don't really take refuge or have the trust. We still take refuge and trust in our self and its stuff. That's where we go for refuge, and our skewed thinking and our, right, and all this stuff. This is unfortunately where we go to issue. You know, this is where we take refuge, right? In this very imprecise, distorted, incorrect way of viewing things. Right? I mean, if you were a blind person, stumbling around in your blindness, right? Doing your best, you know, gotten a stick to sort of go 2-3 feet ahead of you so you don't trip. You know, all the things that a blind person can learn to make their condition more bearable. I mean, blind people can learn how to read, right, with Braille. Blind people can have vocations. And you know what I mean? There's lots of things to remediate their life. But if you asked a blind person, would you want to continue this way? What if you could see? What if you could see? Wouldn't you choose that? And so, again, many of us do our best to remediate our condition, to make it better, to function better, and that's helpful. But we have to understand that the Buddha's path is teaching us, when we talk about waking up, it's like teaching us how to see. And I mean, if I was blind, stumbling about, and I can choose somebody to guide me, would I choose somebody who was as blind as me? Or would I choose somebody who could see? So anyhow, these are interesting things to reflect on. But as to the matter at hand, when I talked 2 weeks ago, and I didn't get too far, that I wanted to do something that I've been wanting to do for a while, I said, because part of our problem, I think, in general, is our minds are not fresh. Our minds become habituated, they become a little dull, they become a little automatic pilot. So we hear these gathas, we hear these verses, you know, just going about our day, and we're not, we don't hear them like for the first time. In the same way we see people in our life, and we don't see them always as if we've never seen them before. We see them with lots of stuff, right? We take them for granted, or we see them with all our projections, right? But, you know, this teaching wants us to clear that away so we can experience every moment, every person, every situation, every experience fresh and new, right? So that's why I want to talk about these. And again, for those who weren't here 2 weeks ago, I believe they're posted or will be on our video channel. So last time, I think I got through the bell chants and the morning chants and the entering the hall chants. So let me just do our evening chant for the, and then again, especially we do this every evening on retreat and other times. So this is the evening chant. With posture upright and stable, I sit at the foot of the Bodhi tree. Body, speech, and mind are one in stillness. There is no more thought of right and wrong. Mind and body dwell in perfect mindfulness. I rediscover my original nature, leaving the shore of illusion behind. Noble Sangha, diligently bring your mind into meditation. So this is, again, this morning we heard the Jacqueline chanted the morning chant. So again, so it's first, it begins with instruction, with posture upright and stable. So that's kind of, you know, take a posture. I think you get that one. You know, that's upright and stable. You feel solid, and right? You're not slouching. You're not laying back. You understand, I'm about to do something that is important and significant. I wanna be sitting up for this. You know, sort of like we sit up for things. I'm like, oops, I better pay attention. Posture upright and stable. I sit at the foot of the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree is the historical tree, it's actually still in India, that the Buddha came to enlighten. He sat under the Bodhi tree. Bodhi means awakening. So I sit at the foot of the Bodhi tree, just like the Buddha. So that's what's being said here. I'm just like the Buddha. The Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, and right now all of us can imagine we're sitting under the Bodhi tree, just like the Buddha. When the Buddha first sat down on the Bodhi tree, he was just plain old Siddhartha. When he got up, he was now the awakened one. So the transformation went on in his meditation. So you imagine, yeah, I'm not just sitting on Nebraska Avenue in the hall, or I'm not sitting in my living room, or people on Zoom, wherever you're sitting. I'm sitting under the Bodhi tree. This is like something sacred that I'm participating in. Body, speech, and mind are one in stillness. So again, I think, you know, we've just been through meditation. You've heard the instructions. Many of you heard them many times. Yeah, you know, my body. So when we meditate, obviously our body is still. Our mouth doesn't move. So we just by doing that, we already have two out of the three. So you're already two-thirds there are in stillness. But there is that mind, right? Now, again, we are not trying to impose a stillness on the mind, which means we're trying to still repress thoughts. That's not the stillness. The stillness is in our awareness, in our mindfulness. Our mind is still, even if there are thoughts going through it. Our mind can be still, even if there are sights, even if there are sounds. Why? Because we don't grasp, we don't push away. That is why the mind is calm. So in our meditation, we are cultivating a still mind. Again, it doesn't mean there aren't ripples of thought passing through, but there are no waves, there are no storms, there are no strong current. There is no more thought of right and wrong. You know, it's always been amazing to me for all these years that no one ever asked me a question about that, right? I mean, it's quite a statement, right? Most people go, what? At least when I first said, I went, what? I mean, no more thought of right or wrong. This, you know, we're going to enter chaos in society, right? If all of a sudden we go, no, there's no, you know, just let go of right or wrong. So, so this doesn't mean that. So right or wrong is a stand-in for all those thoughts, like, dislike, good, bad, right, wrong. Right? All those dualistic ways we divide up the world. In our meditation, we are wanting to have a kind of a true non-dual experience, which means we are no longer judging, evaluating, like right or wrong. We may be making adjustments to our meditation, as you heard in the instructions. We do stop, we adjust. But there's no right or wrong. There's no bad or good. You know, it's just working with what is. So we want to let go of that, you know, thing we carry, because we don't not only carry it in terms of our meditation. You know, many people, oh, I have really bad meditation. And then they kind of spin out, or I'm a bad practitioner. And then they spin out, or then they go, or they think, oh, I'm really having a great meditation. And then they spin out. You know, many ways to spin. But the best way is just have no more thought of right or wrong. Just let things be. Right, wrong, good meditation, bad meditation is something we're imposing on just what is. Mind and body dwell in perfect mindfulness. So that's kind of the ideal, right? Our mind and body are quiet, are still. The mind is alert, aware, and our mindfulness is kind of, in that moment, perfect. We're perfectly aware. We're perfectly at one with what we've set out to do. Right. I rediscover my original nature. Remember, we talked about that earlier. That's what the Buddha did. His awakening is about he rediscovered his original nature, leaving the shore of illusion behind. So, yeah, this is deep. We might say very quickly, what is my original nature? especially since Buddhism says there really is no solid, permanent thing called our original nature. Actually, the truth is our original nature is that we don't have any original nature. Our mind is truly empty of all things. So therefore it is spacious, it is aware, it is knowing. It is all these, but that's what we discover, you see. It's like discovering, you know, like most people, they're totally identified with self, with I, me, my, right? That's the center of their world. And then in meditation, when we go about looking, investigating to find the self, we can't find it. We investigate deeply into our body, into our mind, looking for this self, this voice, this thing that's the center, you know, that's behind all the likes and the dislikes and all the issues and all the, you know, it's all the world of self. And now we turn and we go, you know, I want to find you. You know, you're the one who's causing all the problems. I want to find you. And we look and we look and we look, we meditate deeply. And what do we find? Nothing. We can't find a self. So that's why we say in Buddhism, a self appears, but when you look deeply, you can't find anything. It is a non-self. So looking for yourself, you discover your original nature, which has no self to it. And so we leave the shore of illusion behind. Again, as long as we believe in things that aren't really there, we are deluded. That's kind of basic mental health. That's what a delusion is. We believe something is real that's not real. Right? That's what we want to do. We want to leave the shore of illusion. Illusion means we see things that aren't really there. We see things as being solid when they're really not solid. They're just made up of endless parts, everything penetrating everything else. Right? We think things as permanent when they're truly impermanent. Everything is constantly changing. Right? So, when we see how things really are, we leave aside our illusions. Many of us have left aside our illusions about Santa Claus, right? That was a big one, right? I mean, that was a big illusion, right? You know, and there are probably other illusions, delusions you had at childhood. You might have thought your parents were perfect when you were young, and then you might have gone through a process when you thought they were totally imperfect, right? Obviously, they're somewhere in the middle. But we leave our illusions behind. Right? So we can see clearly. If we live in the world of our delusions, our illusions, our projections, and all our stuff, we're not seeing clearly. We're seeing everything through the filter of our delusions, our illusions, our projections, right? So we want to wake up from that. We want to rediscover our original nature, which really means just how things are. I mean, don't make it into a big deal. I just want to see how things really are. Shouldn't be that hard to see if that's how things really are. But Buddhism teaches us how to look to see. And then it says, Noble Sangha, diligently bring your mind into meditation. That's the final instruction. But this is what we want to meditate on. You see, this is what we want to begin to see. We want to leave the shore of illusion behind. For many of it just means by stop listening to the chatter. Stop listening to the nonsense. Stop listening to the dramas, right? Everybody who's listening to me now knows about the voice of the drama, right? And however old you are right now, and whatever your drama is of today, I assure you, a year ago, you had a totally different set of dramas. And the year before that, you had another set of dramas, right? Endless dramas. It's kind of silly, isn't it? To think, God, I've been having dramas since middle school. Right? I mean, just going to middle school, and who likes who, and who's going to pay attention to, you know what I mean? And who likes who, and who doesn't like who, right? I mean, everybody remember that? I'm liked, I'm not liked, I'm in the in crowd, I'm in the out crowd. Everybody remember that? I mean, you know, is that still your concern today? I hope not. But can you see, I mean, it's just endless. Noble Sangha, diligently bring your mind into meditation. So meditation is kind of a very key part of the path, that it's a way to kind of break through the delusion that, as we often go through our day, we're just kind of lost in. But when we stop and we sit and we're willing to cultivate mindfulness and concentration and then get to insight or direct looking into the mind, we can break out of the spiral of illusion and delusion. And the next one I want to look at is the incense offering, which again, we don't do it every week, but certainly we do it in retreat every day, and we do it at various kinds of ceremonies we have. It's quite beautiful. So it says, in gratitude, we offer this incense to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas throughout space and time. So again, when we offer incense, it's an offering. You see, like we offer incense here. It's an offering. Now here, there is a Buddha. So we offer incense to the Buddha. Incense is very traditional. Offerings have to do with the senses, because we're really offering our senses. So like flowers are beautiful things to look at. When we offer flowers, we're offering sight. When there's often a conch shell or something on an altar, that's sound. Incense is smell. Again, these are the primary organs. So we offer, we were really offering all our senses to be purified. But we offer them in gratitude to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas throughout space and time. Now, why should we be grateful to all the Buddhas throughout space and time? Again, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, let's just say, are enlightened beings. Shakyamuni Buddha, but there have been many Buddhas and many Bodhisattvas who come into this world to show us another way, right? Why should we be grateful to them? If you think about, a lot of people do gratitude practice, right? I mean, and sometimes we're grateful for all kinds of things, right? We can be grateful to our parents, and we can be grateful to our teachers, and we can be grateful to, the person who, did a kind deed to me, or called me up, or, there's all kinds of things, grateful that the day's gone well, There are lots of things we can be grateful for in this life. Many things we're grateful, people are grateful. But to the blind person, the person that gave them sight, restored their sight, I would imagine is the most important person that they've come encountered with in life. They might have encountered lots of nice people. There may be lots of things they're grateful for. But no one showed them how to get rid of their blindness, right? So Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear in the world to free us from all the causes of our suffering, right? We can have lots of good friends, lots of teachers, but very few people do that. So This is why we offer incense to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We are grateful. You know, again, the Buddha, he didn't charge for his teaching. He didn't, what do we say nowadays, monetize it. He didn't monetize the Dharma, did he? He said, oh, I'm going to do a good thing here. Thinking thereafter, after 7 weeks under the Bodhi tree, just reveling in his freedom, thought, I could monetize this. You know, maybe I could get franchises all throughout India, you know, I'm on my way. He didn't do that, did he? He just taught freely. And right up to today, the great teachers all just teach the Dharma freely. Why? Because they want to benefit us. They want to help us. Because like I said earlier, they know that this blindness, this delusion, these illusions that we're caught in are just temporary. Right? And again, while we have many good teachers and helpers in these life, very few of our friends and family show us the way to liberation and freedom. So we offer them incense. May it be fragrant as earth herself. And then it says really what, you know, I mean, it's good to offer incense, but what is the real thing we want to offer? May it be fragrant as earth herself, reflecting our careful efforts, our wholehearted mindfulness, and the fruit of understanding slowly ripening. Okay, so this is, what is the best offering that we can offer the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the great teachers, who have, you know, for 2,600 years, taught the way, shown us the way, endlessly giving teachings, endlessly living, you know, manifesting in their own life, an enlightened way of being. You know, what is the best offering that we can give them? Our careful efforts to what? To do what's right. To not do what's wrong. To do what's beneficial. To not do what's not beneficial. To do what's wholesome and to not do what's unwholesome. To do what liberates me and frees me rather than continuing to do things that just keep me ensnared. So this is, these are the efforts that we want to be careful with. Our wholehearted mindfulness, which means, again, we are, mindfulness means I am mindful of what I am doing. I am mindful of what I want to be doing. And I am mindful when I'm not doing what I want to be doing or should be doing. You know, my life has mindfulness. I have criteria and I'm aware of that criteria. Right? I know when I'm concentrating. I'm mindful when I'm not concentrating. I know when I am speaking in ways that are compassionate or noble and helpful. And I know when I'm speaking in ways that are not. I am mindful, right? So I am careful. I am wholeheartedly mindful. And the third is the fruit of understanding slowly ripening. So this is from our practice of Dharma, study of Dharma, meditation, hopefully our understanding. In the beginning, it's just by sitting and watching ourselves, even as neurotic as we are, we begin to understand ourselves better. Understand why we do the things we do, why we feel the way we feel. Oh, I'm beginning to get it. It's not just random, right? I'm understanding myself better. I'm understanding other people better. I'm understanding causes and conditions. I understand why my mother and father are the way they are, or the way they were, and why people are doing what they're doing, and why the world is the way it is, right? I understand causes and conditions, the fruit of understanding, slowly ripening. Another great American fault, right? We don't like slow ripening, do we? Right, we when we we go to the fruit and vegetable section, we want our fruits and vegetables ripe and ready to eat, right? We don't want to take them home and find out they're not ripe, not happy. Yeah. Our ripening takes time. Many of us get frustrated, right? We're in a hurry. We want to be free of our delusions. We want to be free of our unhappinesses. We want to be free of our suffering. So, you know, historically, we look for quick fixes, immediate kind of pleasures, immediate kind of satisfactions. You know, but if anybody ever has eaten unripe fruit or vegetables, not very tasty, not very nutritious. So we have to be willing to be in this for the longer term. You know, again, if our goals of practice are more short term and immediate, then the slow ripening, you know, because we may not want to really ripen to a deeper transformation and healing within ourselves. But if that is our goal, then we have to accept that even though we are making strong efforts day to day, moment to moment, the ripening takes time. And every fruit and vegetable has its own time frame. So we can't compare ourselves, right? This kind of fruit ripens in such and such a time, you know. Some fruits ripen very quickly, some take a long time. But they all will ripen. Just have to be patient. May we and all beings be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This is a great line. What does that mean? So many of us have companions. We have friends. We have family. We have colleagues, right? They're good companions, right? But they do have their problems. They do have their issues. And, you know, can't always count on them, can you? Can we? So in Buddhist teachings, what we call the Sangha, which in traditional Buddhism is the fourfold Sangha, which is the Sangha of ordained monks, ordained nuns, ordained lay women and laymen. And they all take, you know, like in the ordination in our community for lay people is we take the five mindfulness trainings and the three refuges. So again, that's called the fourfold Sangha, right? Monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen. But there is another Sangha. It's called the Arya Sangha. Arya is the greater Sangha, the higher Sangha. And that is the Sangha of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, right? Which means this first Sangha is characterized by the commitments they've made, right? To follow the five mindfulness trainings, the 14 mindfulness trainings, 257 or whatever it is of a monk or a nun. But these are noble people because they are following a noble prescribed path. Okay, the Arya Sangha. To get into the Arya Sangha, the higher Sangha, you need to have been awakened to your true nature. So with the Arya Sangha, it's not about whether you're a layman or a laywoman or a monk or a nun at the level of vows, commitments. Now it's a matter of realization, right? So, you know, it's sort of like, in my path, depending on my aspiration, who do I want to take as my companions? Right? Doesn't mean we can't have lots of companions, right? But like, who's the most important companion, companions I need to get me where I want to go? And obviously, to be able to access the presence, the teachings of enlightened beings, going back to the Buddha, Right. We can pretty be confident. This is good advice. You know, these are awakened people. They see much more clearly than I do. They see much more clearly than my Dharma buddies even. You know, so while I have lots of Dharma friends, as my real companions on the way, I want Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, teachers, masters, right? These are my companions because they, right? I mean, if there's anything you want to develop yourself in, right? A sport, an instrument, a skill or anything. I mean, right? If you have the opportunity, wouldn't you want to go to the best? I mean, if you want to be a good cook, would you go to somebody who's you know, just as good as you? I mean, it doesn't mean you can't learn from other people. I'm not saying, you know, that, but you go, no, I want to go to somebody really is good, right? Yeah, if I can go to the best, if I can take a master class in the best, yeah, let me do it, right? Because that would inspire us. As well as we know that when somebody who really knows what they're doing is correcting us or pointing out our, you know, where we're off or our shortcomings, we know that they're coming from a place of wisdom, and also having traversed the path themselves. So that's why we and all beings be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's a great wish, right? Wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, every corner, every block, there was an enlightened being, right? Throughout the world, wouldn't that be a wonderful world? Helping beings everywhere, showing them the way. Yeah, so it'd be wonderful if there were lots of beings. So hopefully everybody listening can set the aspiration, yeah, I want to be a companion of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, so I one day can benefit beings, family, friends, society, just like the Buddha did. I mean, look at the Buddha, right? One man. Northern India, you know, pre-industrial, pre-mass communication. Somehow the word got out. And here we are 2,600 years later, still, entering the stream of his teaching and experience. Why? Only because for 2,600 years, there've been people who've said, yeah, I wanna practice this, I wanna realize this, I wanna pass this on. Why? To be of benefit to people. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Again, that's, in Buddhism, there are a lot of these aspirations. You know, we put a lot of emphasis on aspiration, that we have free will, a certain degree of free will. None of us have complete free will. I mean, I can't make myself 17 years old again with a fully healthy body. Right, so I don't have complete free will. I can't fly. So there's a certain context that we all have. But within that context, I have a lot of free will. I have a lot of choice. How I spend my time, the choices I make, what I do, what I don't do. Right? Who I hang out with. What I do, you know, when I turn on the computer, what am I doing? Do I even remember that I have free will in this moment? I can choose what to access, what not to access. See, we all have free will, but we don't exercise it. We forget. I mean, we all have free will what we do the rest of the day, right? You might say, oh, not really, I've already made plans. Well, change them. I mean, you could, right? I mean, if you got sick, you'd call up and change your plans. I mean, I'm not saying, but I'm saying we have free will. That's very essential. There would be no path. There would be no chance for awakening if all of us didn't have this capacity within each of us to give some direction to our life. The more we awaken to that, to that potential within all of us. And the more we exercise it, it becomes stronger. And hopefully we, I mean, many of us might have as children been very willful. Maybe somebody said that about you, right? Or you may still be, as an adult, still be very willful. See, it's interesting, isn't it? See, that could be okay. The question is, what were we willful about, you see? And probably not the most healthiest, wholesome things. Probably mostly it was about what? Getting my way. Right? But if you think about, or like people who are stubborn, I mean, those are qualities, a certain kind of energy that could be used on the path, you see. If we move them in the right direction, you see. So a lot of these energies that kind of have a negative connotation are actually can be used for a lot of positiveness. Right? If you say, yeah, I mean, God, certain things in my life when I want it, I just go for it. Right? Well, why don't you go for enlightenment and put the same kind of energy into that? Same type of singleness of purpose. I want to have a wholesome mind. I'm really going to put my energy into cultivating the wholesome and not cultivating the unwholesome. I'm going to be really stubborn about not cultivating the unwholesome. You see what I'm saying? And that's, so all of a sudden you're using something that has a negative connotation in a positive way. Let's do one more and then I'll take some questions. This is a very profound one. Again, it's really in retreat and ceremonies where we do a lot of more chanting. So we have a chanting service. So we have a practice called touching the earth, where we touch the earth, in terms of offering gratitude to various Buddhic and enlightened forces in the world and our families and parents, so touching the earth, which is sort of the Plum Village way of talking about what traditionally was called a prostration. We touch the earth, showing our deep, heartfelt meaning of whatever we're doing. So this is a very interesting gatha. The one who bows and the one who is bowed to are both by nature empty. Therefore, the communication between them is inexpressibly perfect. Our practice center is the net of Indra reflecting all Buddhas everywhere. And my own person reflects in all Buddhas to whom with my whole life I go for refuge. This is very unusual, isn't it? So before you begin this process of touching the earth and bowing to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and all the various enlightened beings and the teachers and future generations and parents and teachers, and I mean, how unusual this is. The one who bows and the one who is bowed to are both by nature empty. This is that word again, empty, shunyata. So if it is me bowing, the me who is bowing is empty. The thing that I'm bowing to is empty. Again, it's like we talked about earlier, empty of what? Empty of self. Empty of solidity, empty of permanence, right? It is empty of all that. So when we bow in this way, it's pure, isn't it? I have no thoughts about me. I have no thoughts about it. It's just simply the act of bowing. With a grateful heart, just bowing. See, when there's that, when there's nothing there, when it's empty, you're just having a pure experience, right? It's sort of like drinking tea. If I'm here thinking, here I am, I'm drinking tea. I'm drinking tea. Well, I really haven't drunk tea yet. I'm about to drink tea. I'm putting the cup to my lips. I am now drinking the tea. I am now enjoying the tea. I am now not enjoying the tea. I love this tea. I hate this tea. You see, that's not what's being talked about here, because that experience is full of what? Full of me. Can you see? It's full of me. And that's the way we live our life with people, where we're just full of ourselves. And we don't have a pure encounter, even with a cup of tea. See, the pure encounter is just this. Just let it be. Let the experience be. That's how we get the benefit of it. That's how we get the real experience, the real taste, right? But as long as, so it's empty. Empty doesn't mean it's dead. It's very alive. But I'm fully entering into the spirit of whatever. I'm not full of myself. I'm not full of you. You see? The one who bows and the one who is bowed to, both by nature empty. Therefore, the communication between them is inexpressibly perfect. You know, so let's say we bow to each other. Let's just bow to each other. So we bow. In this moment of just bowing, we're just present to each other. We're just experiencing. Your experience, the bowing, I'm experiencing the bowing, but there's no me experiencing the bowing or you, there's just the bowing. Isn't that enough? You see, isn't that enough? What's more is there to understand? Do I have to say, oh, I'm bowing to you? You already know I'm bowing to you. You see it. See, this is not being so caught up in words. So therefore, this communication without words of just being, of just experience, is a very deep communication. It's perfect, you know? How many times have you screwed things up when you've tried to put something into words? Anybody ever do that? You see? You know? It's like, just do something. If you want somebody to know you love them, do something loving for them. Or look at them in a loving way. Right? Right? You understand what I mean. Oh, if you respect somebody, then you bow to them. That's all. Doesn't need to be more than that. Our practice center is the net of Indra, reflecting all Buddhas everywhere, my own person, reflection all Buddhas to whom my whole life I go for refuge. So again, this is from the Avatamsaka Sutra. This is the famous net of Indra. This is in the Avatamsaka Sutra, which many Mahayana consider it's not for the faint-hearted. I think it's like 1,000 pages long. I mean, it's incredible. But within it, there are various chapters. And one of the chapters, they talk about this net of Indra. The net of Indra, Indra is a Hindu god, Indra. And I guess Indra had a net. But this was not a usual kind of net. So at least in the Buddhist teachings on Indra's net, you know how a net is lots of rope or something or twine and they're all intersecting, it's a net. Every place where there's an intersection, there's a mirror. There's a jewel, a crystal. And so if you could imagine that the net of Indra is made up of, you know, it's gigantic, it's the god's net. It's made up of millions of jewels, mirrors, everything reflecting everything else, right? It's like a hall of, you know, like in the carnivals, you know, the house of mirrors You don't know which one is real, right? Everything is reflecting everything else. So this is a metaphor for the Buddhist view of interdependence, interbeing. It stands opposite to our usual way of seeing things as separate. Everything is separate. I'm here, you're there. I'm solid, you're solid. I'm me, you're you. But this view of interbeing, of Indra's net, is we're just endlessly reflecting each other, reflecting everything. Reflecting our families, reflecting our parents, reflecting our teachers, reflecting our culture, reflecting, you know, anything and everything that's ever happened to us. Right now, we're, you know, as we go through our day, every interaction is affecting us, right? It's, you know, it's reflecting here, but we're reflecting in them, right? It's this endless reflection, endless interbeing. It's this wonderful process that we enter into, right? Interbeing. But if we just see ourselves as a separate self, I'm here, this is who I am, let me tell you my narrative, right? That's not the world of interbeing. That's the world of separation and aloneness. The world of interbeing is the world of interconnection. So we, in Buddhism, we let go of this, our strong identification with self, so we can enter the world of interconnection, interbeing. Feel that. Feel diffuse, not in a good way. Feel connected, not separate from. Connected to everything, to everyone, to every experience, every moment. So this is my own person reflects in all Buddhas. The Buddhas reflect in me. I reflect all Buddhas. Every Buddha, every teaching, every being is present in our practice center. It's all available to us. To all of this, with my whole life, I go for refuge. This is so you can see it's quite... There's a lot of teaching there. So let's stop. And I don't know if there have been both with people who are at home, people in the hall, any questions, anything not clear about anything that I've talked about, or how to live this, how to apply it in real situations. So please take a moment. Is there anything that's not clear? Don't be shy. So it could mean that everybody is clear, or it could mean that everybody is so confused that they don't even know where to begin asking a question. So are there any questions? Yes, Maria Teresa. Well, as I say, we have a lot of will. You know, we'll. Oh. Well, in the moment, again, as I say, you know, I'm not going to get into, you know, for those you want to go back to college and major in philosophy, I'll let you talk about, you know, whether there's free will or not. This is concerned philosophers. since the time of the Greeks, if not earlier. But Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on our capacity to exercise our will. Okay, that's, I think, what's important. Our causes, as I say, our causes and conditions bring us here. So right now, each of us, everybody on this call, causes and conditions have brought you to this moment. You are who you are in this moment. You are the product of all the causes, the endless myriad causes and conditions of your life. You couldn't even begin to enumerate. We couldn't have couldn't even think about all the causes of conditions that are produced, you know. I mean, Are you aware of all the causes and conditions that are producing your thoughts? Not even close, right? Yeah, so we don't, so, and yet, you see, most people just are endlessly driven unconsciously by their causes and conditions. Just keep doing it the way, thinking it's their way, they don't realize they are only a product of their causes and conditions, and they're just being driven by it. Their thoughts, their feelings, their choices, their values, you know, just endlessly driven by it. But a spiritual practice of any worth is telling us something different, that this is simply our conditioning, right? This is the way we've been conditioned. And when we see that, we can then begin to exercise our will, right? Which is, okay, here I am in this moment, consciously. How do I choose to go forward? How do I choose to respond in this situation? How do I choose to respond to this thought? How do I choose to respond to this desire or feeling, you know? See, that's where I am free. But to exercise that, I have to be self-aware. I have to be conscious. I have to have criteria, you know, I have to know myself. And I have to have aspiration, clarity where I'm going. So, you know, again, there's nobody on this call who has not been willful in many different ways in this life, right? I mean, there's nobody, you know, we can't survive without a certain degree of willfulness. And many of us have been very willful in going after many different things in this life. And we continue to be willful. And we put a lot of energy into where we will ourselves to go. So, you know, will we all have. How free it is really has to do with our own ability to be more conscious, more awake, willing to be more self-aware, mindful, willing to have strong aspiration. You know, because an aspiration not connected to some kind of will, some kind of conscious intentionality, doesn't go anywhere. I can have great aspirations for myself, my life, my world. I mean, that's good. But, you know, how does it manifest? There has to be some intentionality. There has to be some will. There has to be some commitment. So, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, we talk about what's called bodhicitta. You know, the mind of enlightenment, which means, you know, it simply is, you know, my intention in life is to wake up, is to be free, is to be liberated, is to no longer suffer, is to manifest all the positive qualities that are inherent in my mind. So I can benefit human beings. I can help, well, not just human beings anymore, animals, the planet. I mean, we're too far down the road to only be concerned about human beings. But, you know, so that's in the Mahayana Buddhism, that's our vow. That's our great intention. Well, how do we actualize it? Only through exercising our will to manifest that in our life, in our choices, in our decisions. And all of us are endlessly making our face with choices and decisions. You know, from how do I spend my time, where do I live, you know, all those kinds of things, to, you know, what thoughts am I cultivating, right? Those are all, the more we see, again, it's through mindful awareness, the more I can see, I have this capacity. I can stop. I can pause. I can step back, whatever it is. And I can observe myself, others. I can remember my aspiration, how I want to show up in this life. And then I can do my best to act according to it. Right? We all have that capability. You know, the question is, How much do we exercise it? I mean, that's a reflective question. Why don't we stop? I think it's a good place to stop. Why don't we stop for 2 minutes and ask yourself that question? Do I exercise in my life my own capacity for free will? Something that is free is something that's not bound. Do I exercise my inherent freedom to choose, to see options, to make choices, or not? Just reflect for another minute or two. Perhaps another secondary question to reflect on for a moment is, what would my life look like if I really exercised my free will to be the kind of person I want to be, to show up in the world the way I really want to? What would my life look like?